Hello and welcome to ProEFTRadio.com. This is Hello and welcome to ProEFTRadio.com. This is Lindsay Kenny, your host. I want to welcome everyone and thank you for joining us. It's an honor to have this platform to share ideas with you about energy psychology, EFT, progressive EFT, and other energy field therapies. I started with EFT a decade ago and truly believe it saved my life. If you're new to the energy-based modality of tapping, then please visit us at proeft.com to establish a foundation for the material we'll be covering in these programs. We have a wealth of free or affordable information there to help restore your mind, body, energy, and soul. Again, that's proeft.com. Every Wednesday night at this time, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, we'll be addressing common issues that challenge just about everyone during the course of their lives. We'll deal with stress, anxiety, fear, grief, shame, depression, self-esteem issues, and more. We'll also take on pain and some of the stuck issues, such as weight, clutter, and procrastination. It won't be just me working with you. I've invited some exciting guests who are experts in their fields as well. During many of these shows, you can call in or email us with questions. Our intention with these radio programs is to help you reclaim joy, happiness, and peace of life as you tap away your challenges. Again, thank you for joining us.
Well, my goodness, I'm just a little windbag there, I think. I'm sorry about that. I'm talking too much. I want to introduce us tonight to Loretta Sparks, my friend and EFT master. She's the past president of the American Academy for Psychotherapists, just the recent past president, and a diplomat of comprehensive energy psychology. Loretta's an accomplished psychotherapist in Southern California and L.A. area, and she's one of the leaders of EFTUnited.com, of which I'm a member on the advisory council. And it's an international portal to training and certifications with AAMET, which is our certification and training body. And Loretta's going to be talking to us tonight about compulsive helping. And as I said in my newsletter, I think I may be a perpetrator of that. So welcome, Loretta, and talk to us.
Good. Hi, Lindsay. I'm just delighted to have some time to chat with you and your listeners about this topic. You know, very little is really said about compulsive helping. When I first put together the information on this topic, I had a subtitle, The Silent Sainted Addiction. Because you know, many of us know people that you look at her and say, my goodness, she's a saint. What she's put up with, you know, what she has done for others. And it's always somebody who has really given to the point where their own self-care has been just horrifically impacted in a negative way, you know?
Yes.
And so this started this process that I had. There is some people have said, gee, Loretta, this sounds like a lot like codependency. And certainly on an extreme end, you could say, yes, you know, when you take a look at somebody who would have that label of codependent, you'd say, well, yes, there's compulsive helping. But not all compulsive helping is codependent. You know, it's like on a scale. So I wanted to talk a little bit, you know, about if you're up to it, but I'm also open to any questions you have, Lindsay, or any of your listeners, if they call in. I wanted to talk a little bit about how does that happen so that it just feels natural to us, you know?
I want to hear about that. But while we're kind of on the subject that you mentioned, tell us, or maybe you're going to cover this, Loretta, how it's different than codependency. I had never thought of it that way, but I can sort of see it. But why don't you explain that and then just start telling us about it, and I'll ask questions and...
Now, codependency has a lot of different variations on its definition. You know, I worked in the chemical dependency field for over 30 years, working with families and newly recovering, alcoholics and addicts. So I've had the privilege of being educated by the people that I worked with, you know, somewhere around 14,000, 15,000 folks over a 30-year period. And so what I know is what they've taught me. Now, they've taught me about them, and I have surmised you know, a bigger picture. But indeed, one of the things I know is that everyone is unique. So whatever I'm sharing with you today about that, I want you to know it's my experience and perhaps not everyone's experience who's listening. But basically, when we're talking about someone who's codependent, we're talking about someone whose well-being is dependent on another person's well-being. In other words, unless you are problem-free, I can't be problem-free. If you have an issue or a problem, my whole focus is on settling that for you so that I can relax. And it is done in degrees of intensity up to and including someone who essentially is in orbit around another person's life. Their own sense of self is totally dependent on the other person's process and being.
And often it's the other person's dysfunction. Is that right?
Indeed. Well, of course, the more dysfunctional they are, the more problems they have, and so the more
the more needed they are. They feel more needed if the person is messed up, right?
Well, it's, you know, it isn't always that sense of need, though it's in there. It's usually what people are doing with codependency as well as compulsive helping is that they're, you know, you think of them as really helping the other person, but at the core of it is the anxiety that they feel internally when they see and hear a problem in another. You know, you can, I can remember a time before, you know, this awareness became very clear to me where I could be in my office and I heard someone in the hall with a problem where I'd want to pop up and go out and solve their problem. And no one asked me, you know, and they were perfectly capable of solving their problem. So and was I doing it for them or was I doing it because I felt anxious that I saw a problem? You know, that gets to be the big question. And so where do you, you know, where do you start paying attention to this? You know, how does it start manifesting itself in your life? And, you know, what we're really seeing with compulsive helping is just the tip of the iceberg. Because what we're seeing is a very stress-based behavior that, you know, I'm talking about anxiety. And usually we have people who are just hyper-vigilant when it does come to other people's problems and hypersensitive to them. You know, that's why so many of us make great therapists. You know, I always like
to, you
know, I'm told that Freud said years ago that it wasn't neurotic if you could make a living off of it. You know, and I've always liked that quote so much. I never wanted to find out if it was really the truth or not, you know.
Yeah.
But that hypersensitivity and hypervigilance to others' feelings and problems are really the way that we deal with some very deep issues with ourselves, you know. And when you start backing down, if you think of it sort of like an iceberg and you start looking at the earliest formations of it, what there's a, you know, nature has organized us in such a way that we need to attach emotionally when we're born. We need to feel secure and safe. And if the people who are taking care of us are distracted by life, by their own needs, by illness, you know, all sorts of reasons, and we don't make a strong enough connection, then we have a lot of fear that gets developed in a very early age, pre-verbally. And as we grow and age, if our parents, you know, continue to be other-directed, that fear is further nourished. And so we start talking a lot and fearing a lot about rejection, about people rejecting us because of who we are or who we're not or what we do or what we don't do, you know. So that builds up a lot of energy and fear, so we try to be as many things to people as we can.
Go ahead.
No, and so that's sort of the sort of little pressure cooker that works. Now, not everyone has a pressure cooker that's under maximum steam, you know. But a lot of us have enough concerns about where to put our life energy. You know, is it selfish to take care of yourself? You know, it's confusing. You know, where does self-care start and selfishness start and stop? You know, that's an issue that we have a lot of concern about, you know. And So what we see a lot of times with people is that they have difficulty understanding a balance between themselves and other people, you know?
Loretta, where does it become, where does it cross over the line of people that just want to help? And I definitely put myself in that category, if not in the compulsive helpfulness category, too. But there's just a, I've always had this pressing need to help others, and to a degree, that's good. Where does it cross over to the compulsiveness or to where it's not healthy for either person to do that?
Well, that's a really good question, and part of it has to do, your trigger is that, you know, everyone needs help in life. I don't think any of us are going to get through life without being helped by one person or another, or us helping one person or another. But the problems come in when we intrude in people's lives and they haven't asked us. We just march in the front door, and I remember one time, again, while this was so far out of my awareness, I was chatting with a woman who was showing me her rather large pantry, and I was, you know, chatting with her, and she had this very peculiar look on her face, and I was turning jar after, because she had a whole palette of Laura Scudder's natural peanut butter with the oil on top,
and I
was turning them all upside down, because she didn't know she had a problem, because if the oil was at the bottom, then it would filter up and how not. And she was looking at me quite perplexed, and I realized she didn't ask me, did she? But I was just flipping those puppies over, you know? So in some ways, it was really intrusive into her world. She didn't ask.
Oh, gosh, I can really relate to that one. Some things I have golden straight in somebody's scarf or hat or whatever might be on their body, and they'll say, excuse me, I wanted it that way.
Years ago, I came up with a little program that I used to ask my clients to do, and I'd have them write the word ASK out like an acronym, you know, A dot, S dot, K dot. And it stood for, the A stood for advice, the S stood for suggestions, and I took a little license with the K, and that stood for criticism, constructive, of course. So, you know, so you got advice, suggestions, or criticism upon request only.
So you offer
none of those. And I used to send them out, you know, only to do it 1 to 2 hours at a time, because they'd literally burst for folks who had this problem.
Yeah.
So that's one thing, is that, you know, most of us don't realize that when we march into someone's life, the message is that they are not capable of doing it for themselves. And that's not the message 99.9% of us are trying to, you know, send. We're trying
nor
to
do they want, yeah, nor do other people want to feel that way, that they're wrong somehow. I think as therapists and coaches and EFT practitioners, we sort of do it for a living and assume everybody wants to hear our advice, get our help.
You know, and here's another handy hint for those who are listening. Is sometimes people just need to speak out their problem. And if you're talking to someone who is speaking out their problem, and then you move into advice giving or suggestions or offering criticisms of what they did or didn't do, and you hear yes, but, no, but, yes, but, no, but, you've crossed the line with them. They don't want to hear your advice at that point. They just would like to have your ear to vent, which you may or may not be available for.
Yeah.
But so many people think that when someone tells you a problem, they're looking for an answer from you.
Absolutely.
You know, and a lot of times, particularly with women, we process our problems by talking about them.
Yes. And we get mad at men because we tell them what was wrong with the day, and they want to immediately jump in and help us and give us advice, and we just want to vent a little bit.
That's right, and guys are structurally different. You know, their brains are organized differently than ours, and you know, they will move to problem solve, and then someday they'll say, you'll say, "Gee, I'd like to talk about this," and he'd say, "Why? You don't take any of my suggestions anyway."
Yeah, that's
right. That's a classic one. Yeah. So that's one of the first things that I really recommend, is that you try this little ASK program. You know, a couple of hours a week when you're in the presence of other people. It, naturally, if you're at work and that's your job as a supervisor or a therapist or a coach or what have you, that's different, because people are asking for that. But if you are just out in the world, you know, they didn't ask.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a way sometimes of avoiding being, you know, avoiding being personal with people if you can be in the position of an advice giver. So anyway, mm-hmm. that was one of the ways. Another way that you know if you've gone too far with somebody, because, you know, we do differentiate between helping and enabling. And by enabling, I mean when we help someone avoid the consequences of their behavior again and again. Because, you know, the only way we really learn, right, is through our mm-hmm. life experiences. So when mm-hmm. you step in and help them avoid it, then they're not going to learn. I'm reminded of a mother that I knew who had retired from her job but went back to work to afford to keep her twin sons in automobiles and tools and all manner of things, paying off their tickets and so forth. And it just kept escalating to where she had to pay for lawyers because they got into more and more trouble. And finally, they got to the point where Mama couldn't put enough money on the table to take care of the problem, and they wound up in prison, you know, for years. Now, I'm not saying that if Mom wasn't there, they wouldn't have gone to jail, but they certainly would have had a reality check earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because she kept enabling them to avoid the consequences of their behavior. And one of the ways you know that's happening is that while you may feel guilty if you don't do it, if you do it, you'll feel resentful.
Ah.
And that's how you know you've gone too far.
Mm.
But many of us will do a lot of things to avoid that sense of inappropriate guilt. But you always know that. I'm sorry?
No, I'm sorry. I wanted you to say that again. I thought that was very valuable.
Yeah, I said many of us will go, you know, we'll do anything to avoid that sense of guilt, which is inappropriate. Inappropriate guilt is attached to inappropriate responsibility. There's appropriate guilt and appropriate responsibility. But
mm-hmm.
so often we get caught up, and the way you know you're caught up is that, you know, when you do something for somebody, you should feel good, right? You
mm-hmm.
should feel positive and healthy. But if you feel resentful, that's your cue that you are caught up with inappropriate guilt. You're trying to avoid that, you know, and it's harmful for everybody, including yourself.
Yeah, makes sense. Good. Go on.
So,
keep going. I'm loving this, Loretta.
Well, you know, the other thing that I'm very, very focused on, which is the core of most of my work, and yours too, you know, Lindsay, is the ability to help people take good care of themselves, you know, both physically and emotionally and socially and spiritually, just be able to take good care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to take good care of yourself when you are emotionally held hostage by the past. And that's where, you know, our attraction to emotional freedom techniques, which are brilliantly titled,
mm-hmm.
has drawn us, because we've been able to see the freedom that people get when they are able to use these techniques to free them from the past, where they're held hostage by so often the things they learn to survive in their families of origin don't work when they're out in the world the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But so they wind up, you know, being trapped. And when you are trapped or held hostage, you don't feel like you have a choice about what you're going to do.
Uh-huh.
Feel compelled. Hence the word compulsive. You know, we want to have the choice to help or not to help. But when you don't feel like you have that choice, that's where the compulsion comes in. And that's where the resentment comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So what we're really talking about here is doing our work, as we say in the EFT community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes doing our work means that we have to peel back layer by layer until we start seeing, you know, the issues that were there that in our childhood or in our sometimes in our adult life that reinforced so much old learning. You know, one of the things I like to tell some of the young people that I deal with, and younger is getting older and older these days, to be sure, but people who are very computer savvy, you know, what I share with them, I said, imagine, if you will, there's a piece of your operating system that hasn't been upgraded since childhood. And now that you try to run adult software on it, it crashes. You know, because you find yourself again and again in situations that make you feel, what's wrong with me? You know, why is this happening to me? And so what we can do with EFT, you know, is really upgrade the system.
Good, some reprogramming.
That's right. That's right. By taking the stress off of past traumatic history and beliefs, you know, in EFT we talk about the handwritings on the wall, which can be positive or negative. Now, the positive ones aren't causing us problems because they're the ones that encourage us to be free, you know, to have choice. It's the negative ones that tell us, you know, what we should do and what we shouldn't do and how we should be and shouldn't be, you know. Those are the ones that shut us down with fear. So, you know, when we start to do our work, we start to have to look at our own way of moving through life, because so many people I've talked to, you know, if you ask them what they should do, they are so clear. Well, you know, if I took your problem and gave it to your sister or your child, someone that you really cared for, tell me what you think they should do. And boy, they come out with solid, good answers. So they know what they need to do. And I say, well, how would you do it? Well, they even know how they would do it. So there's nothing wrong with their wise or reasonable mind. Mm-hmm. But emotionally, their emotions are like a tidal wave and just wipe out all of their wisdom and all of their reasonable thinking. And they wind up doing things and helping people that the next day they say, what was I thinking? That was my rent. Or what was I thinking? That was my car. You know, what was I thinking? Well, that's the whole point. They weren't thinking. They were feeling, and they were coming from this intense place of inappropriate guilt. It is so powerful.
Yeah, and compulsion. So that means they when they can't help it, there's a big thing that they've crossed the line when they cannot help themselves. And they feel the guilt and the sense of responsibility and then resentment. It really is making sense.
Yeah, it feels as though they can't help themselves, you know, but we have to remember, feelings aren't facts.
Right.
Feelings are not facts. And they, because you feel something, it doesn't mean that's true. So we have to get those feelings, you know, we've got to get those feelings within at a level where your wisdom and reasonable mind can function. You know, it's like those feelings are screaming in your ear so loudly, there's no other room for thought. Or the fear is so overwhelming, there's no place for wisdom.
Loren, my mother was a compulsive helper for sure, and she would do some unreasonable things. Somebody complimented her earrings or her jacket or shoes or bracelet, anything she had on. She would say, well, here, I'll give it to you. Now, they weren't asking for it. They were just complimenting it, but she felt she had to give it. And so I'd say, Mother, why did you do that? You loved that jacket or that. I'd seen her give away her shoes before, and when she needed them. It's not like she had a lot of money. And her answer was always, I can't help it. And I said, well, don't you wish you hadn't? You really liked that. She said, oh, I did, but they needed it more than me. I said, no, they just said they liked it. Well, she assumes that means they wanted it. But her answer was, I can't help it, like she really couldn't. But you know, if I'm understanding you, that's kind of coming from this fear-based, is that
the anxiety of seeing somebody in need was so great that she fell out of the equation. She wasn't part of what was going on. There was a need, and she had to move on it. And, you know, classically, I can't speak, you know, for your mom, Lindsay, but classically, people who have those profound reactions had very difficult childhoods, very challenging childhoods, you know, where there could have been a lot of sickness involved in the family, a lot of dysfunction of some kind, and they just see other people's needs as paramount and theirs as non-existent, and that they're there for other people.
Yeah, makes sense.
You know, I one time worked with a woman those of us who are children of alcoholics, of which I am, can really see, because as you see your parent their demons chasing them or their needs. Or, you know, you can understand how that can happen. And I was working with a woman years ago who appeared, you know, to have all of this profile. But where her experience was that when she was a little girl, 3 and 4, her two older brothers were in 2 separate hospitals, one for polio and one for tuberculosis. And this was many years ago, this, you know, like in the 30s, I believe, when her brothers were ill. And her mother spent all day going between these two hospitals to see her two young boys. And she took the daughter with her, and then she'd come home, and then she had to get dinner and all these other things. And this daughter figured out the only way she could really help her mommy was to not want anything.
Oh.
And so she learned not to want anything.
Hmm.
And she found men, a man who she was married to for 40 years when I met her, who needed everything. because
so
he was
she
not got well.
Fill that. That was a familiar thing for her to be providing a giver instead of a taker.
Exactly. So there's a lot of ways people can get there, you know, from having an ill parent, ill siblings, compulsive parents who have compulsivity issues, whether it be gambling or drugs, alcohol, you know, all sorts of things. Even acute religiosity can do it. You know, and,
oh, really?
And this is, again, where the child's developmental needs are just not appropriately seen to. Like, I don't think many of us have the picture, postcard, perfect childhood, you know, Walton Mountains on television.
Yeah.
But, you know, none of us have gotten out of childhood, I think, totally unscathed. But some people have had greater challenges than others, and you see it showing up in their adult life by the level of self-care that you see manifest. And again, I
mean the lack of self-care or too much?
The lack of self-care.
Oh, okay.
You know, and people say, but they tell me I feel selfish. And I say to them, well, you know, selfish is an interesting word because selfish means you're depriving somebody of what is rightfully theirs. Self-care is not that.
Yeah.
Self-care means you are a steward of your own self, your body, your mind, your world, you know, your spirit, that you are a steward of that. And
mm-hmm.
you have the right to your time. You have the right to sleep. You have the right to eat and exercise and et cetera, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a vast difference between the two, vast.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, a lot of people feel guilty if a friend or a family member is ill or unhealthy, and they're healthy, as if, gee, if I get sick, then maybe that won't make it so bad that they're sick. And I'm not sure who said this, somebody in the movie The Secret, but sort of like you can't be sick or miserable enough to make somebody else well or happy, or poor enough to make somebody else rich. And yet there's a part of us that feels if we have an abundance of one thing, even if it's health, that's not okay because it's somehow depriving somebody else. So that's a good definition that you just gave.
Yeah.
Can you say that again, Loretta?
About selfish, it's when you're depriving somebody of something that is rightfully theirs.
Yeah.
You know, if someone walks in
with 4
cookies on the plate, and you and I were having a cup of tea and going to have cookies, and there are 4 cookies on the plate, and I ate all of them, that would be selfish because I know you would like to have a cookie or two.
Yeah,
you know?
Don't do that.
I promise.
Especially if it's chocolate chip cookies. So, Loretta, how do people actually come to you with this problem and say, gee, I help people too much?
Actually,
do they recognize that they have this problem?
Yeah, rarely.
Yeah.
Rarely.
So how do you...
They come in with intense dissatisfaction in their life, often feeling depressed. They'll tell me they feel like they have low self-esteem, they're not happy, they're not having any fun. They do present with a profile of depression, but, you know, depression doesn't ebb and flow. Either you're depressed or you're not depressed. And when they go to work or they're involved with something they like, they're not depressed.
Yeah.
But when they're just among themselves in this losing situation where it's all about the other, you know, they feel horrible, and that's what they're usually coming in about, is that, and some of them, which is so interesting, Lindsay, some people, when they're alone, like in between relationships,
mm-hmm.
they're powerful and dynamic, and they take care of business, and they have clarity about their life and where they're going and what they're doing. And then the minute they meet somebody, that starts falling away, and they start becoming really focused on the other person and their life and what they need. And that then sort of devolves into a really unhealthy dependency, mm-hmm. you know?
As yeah, to give their power away to somebody else immediately.
Yeah, and so I call that anti-dependent. When someone is anti-dependent, I don't need you, I don't need anyone, I can take care of my life, I can take care of it. As versus someone who's independent, they have a strong sense of themselves, whether they're with or without somebody, and they're very consistent in their path. Mm-hmm. So when they meet somebody, instead of, you know, them becoming the focus of their life, they become, you know, interdependent. We are able to be there for each other in a balanced way. And as that relationship develops, you know, they develop a very healthy dependency. You know, and it's very interesting because one digs a hole and the other one builds a monument, you know.
Yeah. They often find each other and get married and see they're a disaster or balances in some weird way.
Well, it has so much to do also, you know, with this feeling, because at the bottom of all of this, there's this real concern that I'm not enough, you know, or I'm less than. So you meet somebody, and if they pay attention to you, you give them 100 points, you know, and as you get to know each other, you deduct the points, and after you've been married 6 years with four kids, you're below 50 points, and it's really hard to put a relationship with that.
Yeah.
Whereas people who don't have this problem, they meet somebody, they like them, and they give them 20, 25 points, and then as they get to know them, the points add up.
Interesting.
And we get past 50, now we may be talking about having a committed relationship, you know?
Yeah,
so,
interesting.
So no one's surprised after they get married, right, because they've gotten to know this person. So you see a lot of behavioral things taking place around this dynamic. That's really hard for an individual who's caught in this. The bottom line is they're caught in it.
Mm-hmm.
They're held hostage by it. And that's where I get my drum out, you know, Lindsay, and I start beating that this is not emotional freedom.
That's good. That's exactly right. And the problem I'm seeing with this, well, this is really valuable, but when I say problem, I mean the challenge is in getting people to recognize it and on their own. And I can't think of anybody that's ever come to me in the 10 years I've been doing this that said that they had this problem. And but when they come to a therapist or a practitioner and they recognize it, then it can be dealt with. But I think it sounds like there needs to be some kind of an acknowledgement. I told you in the beginning, I feel like this could be, when I heard your description originally, gee, this could mean me, and I could see some of my clients and friends that this would apply to, but how do I know? You're giving some really good definitions and background so that we can kind of recognize it in ourselves. But then what do we do? Are you at the point yet where you're going to tell us how to fix this?
Well, you know, I also want to tell you that this is really basically the dynamic of, in varying degrees, of any behavior that's designed to self-soothe. Because when you help another person to avoid your anxiety, you're self-soothing.
Mm-hmm.
It appears to be for them, but it's really for you.
Yeah.
It's just like the person who eats eats food to self-soothe, or takes a drink to self-soothe, or, you know, does some retail therapy to self-soothe. You know, it is an avoidance of the point of anxiety to deal with it. So when someone comes in, we usually see the tip of the iceberg, but 99 times out of 100. You see at the very tip of the iceberg, the beginning, this fear of abandonment, because a lot of us just didn't attach well. But we don't talk about abandonment after a few years, do we? We talk about rejection.
Right.
And how much we can't stand rejection, or the shame that we feel, or the guilt that we feel. So those are all triggering words. And it's like, I don't tell people, you know, you got to raise your right hand and tell me you're a compulsive helper. But people will lay open a life that's not working for them because they don't have choices. And they don't have choices because they're being held hostage by these old thoughts that are out of balance, you know? Mm-hmm. And balance is essential for health in everything. And if you don't have balance between you and another person, it's not a healthy relationship. If what you give, you know, and you receive is not balanced out, there's a problem. Needless to say, you know, some days we give more and other days we receive more. But the people I'm talking about, they usually have a shipping dock bigger than their receiving dock.
Oh, that's interesting.
Some people don't even have a receiving dock, and you can back a truck up with everything they need, and they have no way of offloading it emotionally. Like your mom with a compliment. She had no way to deal with a compliment except to self-soothe by giving it away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, she couldn't say thank you or it's how nice of you to notice. It was, she had to do something about it, and it really was compulsive with her.
Yeah, and so she just didn't have, as I was saying, this receiving dock where she could receive a compliment. I remember as a young woman, I had to learn just to simply say, thank you, period. You know, and that's also a good place for a lot of people to start, is just to learn to say thank you when they're given a compliment, rather than not judging it.
You know, we need to have a visual so we can see when the other one's talking. There's a little lag, and I keep interrupting you. I apologize for that. For people that are just joined us late, I just want to make sure, you know, we're talking to Loretta Sparks about compulsive helpfulness, which I don't suffer from at all. You just said something that...
Yes, person.
You just said something that triggered something, Loretta, that I've observed in people, clients and friends, and that's the people that don't accept compliments, that don't have that receiving dock, and that's a great analogy. They seem to be void of that. They feel embarrassed or ashamed or uncomfortable if someone says, gee, your hair looks great, what beautiful eyes, that's a nice dress, and they don't know how to deal with that. And years ago, I dated way before I was married to my wonderful husband, I dated a beautiful man, gorgeous physically and emotionally and in every way, and was successful. And he just had the package. And he got a lot of compliments for that, for his success, his charisma, and his looks and things. And he had a great way of handling it because he just got compliments all the time. And I learned this great lesson from him because he had a receiving and unloading dock. He had both sides. Uh-huh. He would just say in the sweetest way when somebody would say, gee, you look great, or what wonderful hair, or great voice or something, he would say, aren't you sweet to notice that? Aren't you? And isn't that nice of you to say that? He would turn it back to a compliment on them and make them feel good. He was actually a little uncomfortable getting all that praise, but it made him feel good to turn it around. And I thought that was a nice way of dealing with it, and most of us don't have the coping mechanism to take that in if we're just giving all the time.
You know, you remind me, and that is a lovely way of dealing with it because everyone feels good at that point. Many years ago, I was teaching at one of our local community colleges in the psych department, and I was walking across campus with the head librarian, and she said to me, she paid me a compliment about my teaching, things that she'd heard, and I said to her, I said, well, thank you. I said, you know, you just made my day. And she said, well, I don't believe in waiting till people die to give them their flowers. You know, and I realized not long after that anytime someone gives you a flower, a compliment, and you in some way dismiss it, it's like taking that flower and stamping on it.
Yeah, yeah. Just like people say, well, that's a nice dress or nice hairdo. And I say, oh, this old thing, or you're kidding me. Oh, my hair looks awful today. And it just totally flattens the other person. Yeah, you don't want to come. Yeah, you don't want to say that again to them.
Because, you know, what they're usually trying to do is that they would feel, at that point, a lot of people can feel more than, and they don't want you to feel bad, so they'll level themselves out again.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah. So it's a bit of an issue. So, you know, the thing is that what do you do about it? Well, you know, in EFT we have such a wonderful process called the, you know, personal peace procedure. And you know, it's a very powerful, powerful tool. And I recommend that people, you know, educate themselves on what the personal peace procedure is. You know, you can start doing your homework. I always like the breaking it down into decades, because that sometimes can be very helpful. Like, you know, before the age of 10, you know, what did I know about helping? You know, what did I know about, you know, doing any of these things? Who taught me that? You know, what's my earliest memory of it? You move through that, and there's a little protocol that you can use, and I'm happy to share with people if they want to, you know, email me at loretta@selfcarepower.com. I'm happy to send them this little beginning personal peace procedure process that's very, very useful. But you need to go through and release the stress and anxiety associated with these early memories. And when you release the stress and anxiety, then you, along the way, also start building up your muscle. And one of the best ways I know to build up your muscle is, and I'm going to ask your patience for just a second, is that you take pride in your daily activity. And pride is another acronym. If you take a piece of paper and write out the word pride in big letters. Mm-hmm. You know, take a second and do that. The P would stand for personal.
Mm-hmm.
The R would stand for responsibility. The I would stand for in. The D, daily. And the E, effort. Personal responsibility and daily effort. You can take real pride in yourself if you do that. Now, how do you know when you've done that? Well, you just sort of ask yourself the question, whatever you're planning to do, would I want my son or daughter to do that? Mm-hmm. And from this day forward, you only would do what you would want your son and daughter to do or your best friend to do. You'll find that your decisions will be more thought-provoking than not. You know, most of our behavior around this is reactive rather than responsive. And the word, you know, respond comes from the word ponder, to think.
Mm-hmm.
So when you respond to a situation, you think first. When you react, it's sort of like the doctor hitting your funny bone on your leg, you know, pop.
Mm-hmm.
The automatic behavior kicks in. So we want to get thoughtful. So the first thing we've got to do is start looking at where do I feel resentful or guilty or, you know, hyper-responsible for other people. That's inappropriate guilt, inappropriate responsibility. Where do I feel resentful? These are all clues, you know, that there's something sapping your energy. You know, yesterday is still holding on to you. And your choices are very limited. So
yesterday is holding on to you, and your choices are very limited. I like that.
Yeah.
Loretta, before we go any further, give that your email out again, would you? We'll do it at the end, but I know people are sitting there with their pens writing.
Sure. Loretta@selfcarepower.com.
Selfcarepower.com. Okay.
Right. And if people would like to, you know, have a few setups, Lindsay, would you like me to give them a few setups?
Yes, I would.
Do some tapping.
I would absolutely love that.
Okay, here's a few of them, and I'm going to say them slowly so you have a moment. I'm going to say them once, and I'll go back and say it again so that you can have a moment to write them down. But the first one is, my needs are not as important as others.
Mm-hmm. My needs are not as important as others.
Yeah.
And when you say explain to those, you know, I caution people they need to have a foundation for EFT, but when you say set up, this is where they're going to be on their karate chop saying,
right.
Even though my needs aren't as important as others.
That's an excellent point. I'm making the assumption that you have just a bunch of EFT kamikazes on this phone call.
Yeah.
No,
that's right, probably.
You'd be tapping on the karate spot that my needs are not as important as others. And if there's a specific person that you could think of that you've been giving to the point of pain, then use that person's name. you know, so-and-so, my needs are not as important as so-and-so's. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, you tap again on the Karate Top Shop spot, and I use the reminder of just others when you do this one. You know, just others or that person's name. Your unconscious uh-huh. mind will know exactly what you're talking about. Now, when we're assuming if you're going to, you know, pick that one that you know to rate it before you get started when you think of that person.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to tap around with it and see if it's changed. And if it keeps going down as you repeat the protocol, I'm not sure how much detail to go into, Lindsay, about doing it.
Let me back up for a second. So that what they would be rating would be how true the statement is that my needs are not as important as others?
Yes.
Okay. And so, and for a lot of for mothers, they put in children because I think mothers are one of the ultimate compulsive helpers. And so they'd say it's not as important as my children or my son or daughter. And they just tap on, they do that setup, and then they just tap on you're saying the reminder would be not as important as others, or is that what you were saying?
The reminder would be, and this children is pretty broad. There may be a child, but, and again, it depends on the age of the children. Children are a pretty tricky one to pick because they're you know, the mother is the caretaker, so it's kind of challenging. But
well, but sometimes these are teenagers or adult children. I guess that's
right.
What
As I said, it depends upon the age. You know, it depends upon the age. And again, we're talking about self-care. Just as an aside, one of the ways I talk to women about whether or not they're practicing self-care is for them to go into their dresser drawer and look at their dainties. And if their undies are things that they would not want anyone to see, that's an indication that perhaps they need to beef up their self-care.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
When somebody says they're 40 or 50 years old, I'll say, oh, please, I've got underwear that old. So that's not a good thing.
It's not a good thing if it's held together with safety pins with large holes and rags.
Oh, no. Duct tape is really uncomfortable, I found.
That's right. Duct tape is uncomfortable. I met a woman a few months ago who came up to me at a conference, and she looked at me and smiled. She said, my underwear drawer is beautiful now, Loretta.
Oh, that's a compliment. That's great.
There you go. So going to my needs are not as important as others.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be accepted unless I do what others want.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. I don't ask other people for help.
So I don't. I won't be accepted unless I do what others want. And I'm sorry. What was the last one?
I feel guilty if I don't do what people want.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And with each one of those, see if you can sit down for a moment and see if there is a situation or a person that comes to mind when you think of that.
Yeah.
And then see if there's a situation or experience that you had with that person that just sort of jumps out at you. And then see if that situation or experience you had with that person had a strong emotion attached to it.
Like what would a common emotion be?
I'm sorry?
What would a common emotion be that would be attached to that?
Well, you know, you look at the basics, mad, bad, sad, you know, guilty.
Guilty.
You know, some intense. Difficult emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, now you've got really a meaty thing to tap on, and then you think for a moment, like, how strong is that emotion? 10 being as strong as it can get, and 0 meaning it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
The odds are, and if you cannot pick a number, the odds are it's pretty high because you're remembering it.
Yeah.
And so just jot that down on a piece of paper. Jot the feeling, the emotion, and the event. And then you would develop a setup, which would be somewhere you'd use the feeling that you had that even though I feel angry when I think of John. I accept myself deeply and profoundly. I feel angry when I think that John did not return my power saw, you know, or did not return X, Y, or Z, the money he borrowed from me. You know, I accept myself deeply and profoundly.
Mm-hmm.
And you use that as your setup.
Or resentment that you did this favor for someone and they didn't seem to appreciate it. They didn't ask
right.
for it. They didn't need it, but you gave it to them and then you're mad because they didn't act like they appreciated it.
Absolutely. And, you know, you will find the right emotion attached to the event if you just give yourself some calm to think about it. And you bring up a really excellent point, Lindsay, because there are times that those of us who are very aware and hypersensitive to people can often see things that they would be able to use or it would fit into things that they like, and we may, without request, deliver it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are nowhere near as thrilled as we think they should be.
That's right. I'm sure you've had people give their family members a gift certificate or, you know, such to a session with you. And the family member's going, I don't need that. Why are you giving me weight loss DVDs or whatever, cooking lessons or something?
It right.
It feels sometimes a little
And again, we go back to the basic ask. No one asked.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, like your ASK thing. ASK, and those of it might miss this, the acronym with a little cheating on the K part,
yeah.
The E part, is advice, suggestion, and criticism. So that is, don't, and how did you phrase
criticism,
it?
We must say, not negative, but even constructive criticism.
Which a lot of us will try to frame criticism in. Bless her heart. Bless your heart, but that just
That's
doesn't
right.
look good on you.
That's right. And did I ask? You know?
Right. Upon request only. I like that. Ask upon
yeah.
request only.
And there
okay.
there is, you know, the this other part of it, which I think is really important, because there are so many little potholes that we can fall into, and some of them are really big. So the personal peace procedure, which is core to all of our work, any one of us who are fortunate enough to have EFT in our lives, because as we are able to resolve the stress associated with the past, that energy that went into holding that memory is now released to us, and we have more energy to be in our life in the moment. And as we have more energy, we have more choices. And, you know, I often tell my clients, I have no idea how you should live your life. I have enough of a challenge with my own. I do know, though, that if you have a choice, you will have a better life than as
mm-hmm.
if you felt stuck.
No, that makes sense. Absolutely.
Okay.
I had a question on the tip of my mind, and it just slipped right out. We've got about 8 minutes, so, or about 7 minutes left. And what do you want to make sure that you get in for people? This is I was wondering if we could fill up an hour with this topic, but my gosh, there's just a lot of meat here.
Well, people might like to know that, you know, I have on my website right now, I have a DVD that goes into this material in detail. There will be a workbook coming probably late spring, but right now the DVD is available. And it's been found to be very helpful, though it is a bit detailed. It's about an hour and 40 minutes.
So it's a video or audio?
It's video.
It's video. Okay.
It's a video. I had obviously a lot to say, and it's a pretty little PowerPoint. So they might, you know, people who would like to get a jump start on this might find it helpful. But it's, again, it's core, because we're talking about self-care. And when someone asks you to do something, I recommend strongly that whenever someone asks you to do something, that you pause. And until you get really good at being able to say no, because so many of us, you know, no is not an option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So many people struggle with saying no. And if you are one of those people who can't say no, then I recommend that you say to them, let me get back to you.
Great.
Never,
perfect.
Ever say yes.
Mm-hmm.
Always say, let me get back. They'll say, but I need to know right now. I'll get back to you in a minute. Just
mm-hmm.
give me a moment. And get them out of your face and stop and think and ask yourself these three questions. Do I want to do what I was asked to do? Do I have the time to do what I was asked to do? And do I have the wherewithal to do what I was asked to do? You need three yeses to do it.
Do I want to do it? Do I have the time? And do I have the wherewithal, the knowledge, the skill, the ability?
Or the money.
Okay.
You know, someone wants to help you, you know, someone wants you to help them move, and maybe you're really happy to help them move, but, you know, you have a back issue. Somebody needs money, and while you would love to give them money, you don't have it.
Yeah, I remember in our EFT United meeting where we established our alliance with AAMET for training in the EFT Advisory Council. Somebody, and I won't mention the person, raised their hand about volunteering for a project, and I said, no, you can't do that. You're already overextended. You're already overcommitted. I could see the light in her face kind of go, oh, yeah, that's true, but I want to help. Do you remember that?
Yes, very clearly.
So why didn't somebody do that to me? Say, Lindsay, quit saying, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the goal, of course, is to be able to internalize that self-care.
Yeah.
And not look for it externally, but again, you know, you ask that question, you know, do I want to do it? Do I have the time to do it? And do I have the wherewithal to do it? And that could be anything from a truck. You know, one of my favorite stories, I was talking to a client years ago whose wife was very angry at him because on Thanksgiving morning he drove down to the gas station to get some gas, and they were having people coming over to dinner, family, and he didn't come home until 11 o'clock that night. Why? Because he met somebody at the gas station, his car broke down, and he drove him home to Palmdale.
Oh, my goodness.
Which was hours and hours and hours in both directions.
A stranger?
Yeah.
Was it a stranger?
A stranger.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, he needed your DVDs. By the way, I don't want to end the hour. I want to make sure you give your website where they can find that DVD.
Right. Currently, they can go to energypsychotherapy.com. Energypsychotherapy.com.
And what's the title of your DVD?
Compulsive Helping, strangely
enough.
Oh,
I'm so shocked.
Yeah. Won't
so energypsychotherapy.com.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, I want to go back to this little thing that you just did, this little key at the end. The tapping is great, and you need to tap on it. But I think that's brilliant, Loretta, to say, let me get back to you on that. Words that are not in my vocabulary. I either say yes or yes. And so I'll get back to you, or let me think about it, or something. And then you ask the questions, do I want to do this? Do I really have the time? Gee, who does?
Mm-hmm.
And do I have the wherewithal? I think that is such a key thing to do. And then go tap on your guilt because you'd say no.
Right, because the guilt is inappropriate because you're practicing self-care. Those are three self-care questions.
Yeah.
Not selfish, self-care.
That's really important. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, so there's a lot of tapping to be done here. So I think your DVD is going to be a big hit with this group if they're listening. I'm sure they're recognizing the symptoms as I am. So we just have a few seconds left, Loretta. I want to tell you, I didn't say this at the beginning, besides liking you, your audaciousness and being outspoken and all of the other wonderful things about you, I've always thought that you were brilliant. And I think this is just a terrific process and recognition, and I really want to thank you for coming on the show tonight. It's been absolutely valuable. This will be in the archives for people to listen to, and so let people know, Loretta, to listen to this from your site, and they can go to proeftradio.com and find it. Thank you so much for being a guest, and I hope you come back and visit us sometime.
Well, I do, Lindsay, and you are one of the special people in my world, so thank you for asking me.
Well, thanks, Loretta, and thank everybody for joining us. We're going to wrap up now. Join us next week at Wednesday at 6 p.m. Pacific time for proeftradio.com. And Loretta Sparks, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.